This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. 5 days into the massive cyber attack at Optus, the telecommunications giant is still no wiser about who hacked its systems, potentially exposing the private data of almost 10 million customers. As Optus grapples with the crisis, the federal government is fine-tuning reforms to privacy laws to ensure that banks can be quickly informed about data breaches so vulnerable customers can be better protected. Our senior business correspondent Peter Ryan is following developments. Peter, it's been days since Optus revealed this massive cyber attack. Has there been any communication from whoever did it or a ransom demand?
Well, good morning, Sabra. Optus says it's had no contact with any hacker and there's been no demand so far for a ransom in return for the data, which in the worst case scenario, according to Optus, could impact 9.8 million customers. An Optus spokeswoman tells me the attack is still being investigated by the Australian Federal Police, who've advised the telco not to comment on certain aspects of the investigation, including verifying the authenticity of customer information published on the internet. Now, this refers to an unverified post demanding $1 million in cryptocurrency not to sell the information on, and a week to decide. But experts warn hacking forums are known to post fake claims to scare companies into paying up. The telco's owner, Singtel, has a scheduled board meeting in Sydney this week, and Optus boss Kelly Bayer-Rosmarin will be updating, no doubt, on the breach as the crisis deepens.
The federal government's clearly worried about the exposure to Optus customers and other companies. What can it do to toughen privacy laws?
Well, Sabra, we know that the Home Affairs Minister, Claire O'Neill, is expected to announce reforms this week that would force businesses like Optus to alert banks immediately about any breaches that could expose customers to hackers. Banks already have their own firewalls, of course, and are constantly vigilant to stay ahead of the hackers. But the idea is that if banks get told without any delay, they can then apply even greater scrutiny and advise customers to, for example, put limits on transaction amounts, leaving accounts, and so they can also more easily dispute transactions. The Australian Banking Association issued a statement saying banks remained vigilant to scams and frauds and have spent around $19 billion on IT systems to build resilience against the cyber crooks.
In the past, Optus has opposed reforms to the Privacy Act. Could this attack see that change?
Well, Sabra, they might have no choice now if the federal government pushes these reforms through. They were actually proposed in the works already before the attack. In 2021, Optus made two submissions to an inquiry saying the current Privacy Act worked well, saying a right for customers to erase their data or to have it destroyed would have big compliance costs and limit the benefits of the digital world, an argument that might have to be walked back, especially with that potential 9.8 million Optus customers increasingly anxious about how their personal information might be exposed to criminals on the dark web.
Peter Ryan there. The Albanese government's hoping to tick off on one of its signature election promises during this week's sitting of federal parliament. Much anticipated bill setting up the National Integrity Commission will be introduced. And while we don't know all of the details of the model yet, crossbench MPs have still got a few questions about it. Political reporter Claudia Long has more.
After a delay to allow federal parliament to mark the death of the Queen, the Albanese government's plan for a National Integrity Commission is about to be revealed.
It's been a long wait and I'm welcoming this with great gusto.
The independent member for Indi in Northern Victoria, Helen Haynes, has been campaigning for a federal anti-corruption watchdog for years.
I've had constructive conversations with the Attorney General and his team. This issue about third parties is one that we haven't had a resolution on.
Those details about exactly what power the body will have are a potential sticking point when it comes to getting crossbench support.
The government have indicated now that contractors would be included under third party. But what we don't know is whether other groups such as lobbyists, such as businesses, such as unions, for example, would be included. So we await to see what the detail of the bill actually is.
Independents and other crossbenchers say they want an anti-corruption body with teeth, and they've been raising their concerns with the government for months. Independent Zoe Daniel says, like many of the others, she wants to ensure it has jurisdiction over third parties who seek to improperly influence government decisions and funding.
Why would you quarantine unions from that process? Why would they be any different to any other organisation? So I do believe that unions should be subject to investigation as needed if the Commission believes that that is necessary.
And strong protection for whistleblowers is another key aim.
Whistleblower protection is really critical. The government doesn't want to put whistleblower protection into this bill, so they want to separate it out into separate legislation. That's maybe okay, but that is something that I'll be very much keeping the pressure up for.
Labor may not need the support of independents or minor parties if the coalition gets on board. Shadow Finance Minister Jane Hume says there are still key questions to be answered.
Public hearings, private hearings, whatever it might be, how do you fund a case if somebody accuses you? How do you be absolved if there's nothing wrong? How do you retain your reputation, your professional reputation, your employability, your mental health?
However, while the exact details of the legislation are yet to be seen, opposition leader Peter Dutton has told Four Corners the coalition has been talking to the government.
I think the two issues that we had as a former government with the Integrity Commission, one about public trials and that's the show trial element, which is still problematic, and the government concedes that point. And secondly, I think, you know, the other difficulty that that we had was some of the breadth, and I think that's being addressed by the government as well. I think they're fairly pragmatic in their approach, and as I say, we're working constructively with the government. They'll have a bill shortly, and I suspect we'll be in a position to support that.
The Labor caucus will get a look at the plan legislation tomorrow, and it'll be introduced to Parliament soon after that.
Claudia Long. Another of Labor's election promises was to scrap the compulsory cashless debit card. Under the scheme, some welfare recipients had their money quarantined so it couldn't be spent on alcohol, gambling or withdrawn as cash. The government's bill to repeal it should be voted on in the Senate this week. People can still choose to have their income managed, and they'll go on to a new enhanced card, which will also give them more of a choice about where it can be used. Amanda Rishworth is the minister responsible for it. Amanda Rishworth, from October, people who are on the cashless debit card can leave it. How many of the 17,500 recipients do you think will want to stay on the card?
Well, look, we're not sure how many people will want to stay on the card, but we think it's very important there's an option for people to do so. In my consultations within communities, there are mixed views. Some people said that they would stay on it if it was voluntary. Others have made it very clear that they won't stay on any sort of income management because it is not working for their lives.
People in the Northern Territory and Cape York programs who are on a similar scheme won't have a choice. They'll be transferred to the new enhanced card. Is that fair?
Well, look, when it comes to Cape York, that is a different model that it is not like the other sites in which anyone on a working age government payment was automatically put on the card, whether you'd touched a drop of alcohol or not. In Cape York, it is a model where individuals are referred as an option with elders, as well as a number of other interventions as part of the Families Responsibility Commission. So that is a very self-determined process. Certainly doesn't involve everyone across the community being put onto income management, but as an option for elders in the community to work with those that they are doing.
In the Northern Territory, something like 23,000, mainly First Nations people, are still on this card. Is that fair for them?
Well, look, the what's been commonly known as the basics card predates the cashless debit card. We have said that we, in the long term, want to see income management voluntary, but we do need to consult with communities when it comes to the income management, and we'll do so. Our first priority, of course, is abolishing the cashless debit card, but over time we will work with communities in the Northern Territory about what that transition looks like.
Under this new enhanced card, 50% of income, not 80%, will be quarantined, and people have more places to use it and can use things like BPAY. You'll also consult with communities about what income management looks like beyond July next year. What do you need to consult about?
Well, look, some people have told me that while they like the new enhanced technology, they would like to have a PIN on that card so that other family members can't use it. For others, there are specific products that they want blocked. Now, these are technological questions as well as we need to see if communities want those sorts of things. So they are some of the issues that we're exploring. But in addition, we also want to talk about what community volunteerism looks like. Communities in some places, particularly in remote areas, have indicated to us that they are interested in exploring what a community-based model might look like in terms of income management. So there are some of the issues and questions that we'll be exploring with communities.
Over the weekend, the government announced that you were introducing $67 million for additional supports in communities that have the card, more drug and alcohol services. Was that done to secure votes in the Senate?
No, it was about delivering services that communities were saying that they needed and that they wanted and that would actually address the underlying problems. What communities have told me, and certainly what the evidence backs up, is that the cashless debit card, despite what the opposition was saying, was no silver bullet when it comes to complex issues in communities. So we want to actually support communities in things that work. So whether that is drug and alcohol or other programs, it's critically important that we deliver.
If that was the case, why wasn't this introduced when the bill was introduced into the lower house, full stop?
Well, the bill was introduced. The services and the announcement that we've made have been through careful work of me consulting with communities. Between myself and the assistant minister, we visited all communities and heard about what important services are needed on the ground. It's more than just drug and alcohol services. We've been speaking with communities about local jobs programs and for example, a community bus that is desperately needed in communities where there wasn't money in the budget after July next year. So this is the work that I've been doing, is working with communities about what are the services and supports they need and how we deliver them.
The $17 million that's been set aside for community employment initiatives, will it lead to meaningful work for people?
Well, our intention is to co-design that with communities. So we already have a number of community leaders with different proposals of what they believe will generate work and income, economic development in rural and regional areas. So we will be working with communities about what they believe will actually generate work and employment.
Minister, thanks for talking to AM.
Thank you.
And Amanda Rishworth is the Minister for Social Services. Torres Strait Islanders hope a landmark ruling by a UN committee will spark action on climate change that could help save their island homes. UN Human Rights Committees found Australia violated the rights of a group of Torres Strait Islanders by failing to adequately protect them from the impacts of climate change. As Annie Guest reports, Torres Strait Islanders are hoping it'll prompt governments to consult them more about climate action.
For all of her 56 years, Nazareth Fayoud has lived on Porama Island. It's also known as Coconut Island, but its landmarks are changing as sea levels rise.
Most of the coconut trees are like falling now, like sad to see, like they just washed out, you know. And the island is like getting like smaller.
And as water warms around the island, 130 kilometres north of the Australian mainland, the grandmother says reefs are bleaching and fisheries depleting, along with other food sources.
Because of the heat, the sand, the soil is getting a bit drier. So most of the time, like when it's monsoon, yeah, like it's helping our crops.
She's one of eight residents from the low-lying Boigu, Porama, Warraba and Masig Islands who, along with six of their children, filed a complaint with the UN Human Rights Committee in 2019, alleging the Australian government failed to adapt to climate change by upgrading seawalls and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The committee found the government has failed to do enough to protect the islanders against adverse impacts of climate change and must provide compensation and adaptation measures.
I feel really happy. I feel that my ancestors was, you know, listening in.
How hopeful are you now that this United Nations decision will lead to more action on climate change that could benefit your island?
Well, I just cross my fingers or hope and pray it's going to help benefit my community.
But Ned David, the chairman of the Torres Straits GBK Land and Sea Council, has this message for the federal government.
This has been a First Nations traditional owner-led campaign. The takeaway from this is, you know, around, you know, the sea walls or any of the other adaptation measures that we're considering, that they speak to the right group. We, you know, we need to be in that conversation representing the interests of our people.
A spokesperson for the Attorney General, Mark Dreyfus, says the government is considering the committee's views and will provide its response in due course. Meanwhile, Ned David is reflecting on his people's history of campaigning for their rights, such as Mer Islander Eddie Mabo's High Court success that led to native title.
I'm proud of the fact that, you know, my people, I guess, have a history of, you know, playing the David in the David and Goliath space and coming out winners. But in many ways, they're certainly taxing on people, financially challenging, certainly for us. It can be so lengthy that along the way you lose, you know, a number of your elders who don't get to enjoy, I guess, the fruits of that labour.
He adds, Australia should be mature enough to replace litigation with dialogue.
Annie Guest reporting. Hong Kong reopens to the world today without hotel quarantine, more than 2.5 years since borders were shut for COVID. The city's had some of the world's toughest COVID controls, and many there hope the reopening is a step towards Hong Kong bouncing back as a global hub. East Asia correspondent Bill Birtles reports.
Few cities have been changed by COVID as much as Hong Kong. The pandemic has shut Asia's so-called world city off from the world. Closed borders, hotel quarantines of up to 21 days, mandatory isolation centres for positive cases, and a surge in deaths when the virus first broke through properly. Hong Kong has seen it all. But the end of hotel quarantine has office worker Andy Gu seeing better days ahead.
Oh, definitely happy. Like I said, Hong Kong, it's about time to open up. We need to stay competitive on the global market, jobs, get the economy going. I'm looking forward to traveling again. It's been years and, you know, I want to go home to Taiwan, to America to see my family.
Authorities in Hong Kong are stressing the city isn't fully opening up. Arrivals still need to line up for PCR tests in the first week. They're banned from bars for the first 3 days. And flights in and out of the city are still limited, so tickets are hard to get. Rob Quinlivan heads the Australian Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong and says today's opening up is a step towards normality.
Well, it's a big and meaningful step forward to have the quarantine hotel relaxation. It'll certainly make life a lot easier for residents in Hong Kong coming back and forth.
He believes Hong Kong will bounce back eventually as a global business centre, but says the last couple of years has been tough, with many expats leaving.
And most of the families that I know have had to make all sorts of arrangements over the last couple of years, whether that's separation of families, one partner or one member of the family staying in Hong Kong and the other being offshore. It's presented real challenges. In my own situation, I've had to move my daughter to boarding school in Australia, and I've spent significant time away from my wife. So it's been a real challenge.
Schools in Hong Kong are still heavily affected by COVID measures, including closure when cases are detected. Masks are so widespread that Hong Kong education officials recently published a video of schoolgirls playing the flute with masks on. Such is the balancing act the city's government faces, trying to reopen while being part of China, a country that's rigidly sticking to a COVID zero policy on the mainland. In the past week, Taiwan and Japan joined Hong Kong in also announcing the easing of their COVID border restrictions, meaning mainland China is increasingly going it alone on COVID zero as the rest of Asia moves on. This is Bill Birtles in Taipei reporting for AM.
And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It was largely eradicated almost 50 years ago, but the crippling disease polio is making a comeback. Today, the health commissioner from the US county, where there are already hundreds of cases, what needs to be done to stop the worldwide spread. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.